Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Institute for Holocaust Education on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Holocaust survivor Lou Leviticus, professor emeritus at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, and volunteer curator at the Lester F. Larson Tractor Test and Power Museum in Lincoln. Professor Leviticus' talk was given as part of the Through the Eyes of a Survivor speaker series presented by the Institute for Holocaust Education at Omaha's Jewish Community Center. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, July 28, 2010, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Institute for Holocaust Education, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Beth Selden Dotan, Executive Director of the Institute for Holocaust Education.
We are privileged this evening to have Lou Leviticus join us. He came from Lincoln to speak to everyone. Lou speaks quite often in the schools in Lincoln and travels as far as Grand Island, and he's gone to Central City and Hastings, and we bring him to Omaha when we can as well. And he has another unusual and amazing testimony for us to bear witness to. So I will let Lou begin. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Beth. Well, my story is probably quite different from that of many others you've heard. I was born in the Netherlands in 1931 in a small village in the eastern part, close to the German border. And and in those days, people were born, and some of you may remember, they were born in their mother's house or in their grandmother's house or somewhere like that. And that's what happened to me. I was born in my grandparents' house, my mother's parents, in the tiny village in the eastern part. But we lived in Amsterdam. So after some time, and I can't tell you how long that was, my mother and I went back to Amsterdam, where I started my regular life as a Jewish kid in a non-Jewish environment. But I didn't know really that I was Jewish. I never had any bad experiences that I can remember anyway. During all the years that I lived in Amsterdam, except until World War II. I went to regular school. We were not religious at home, so we did not go to the synagogue. And if we would have gone, which we did from time to time on the high holidays, my dad took me to the Portuguese synagogue because that's where he was a member. His family, and therefore my family, came from somewhere in Spain and had been exiled from there in 1492 by good Queen Isabella. And they ended up, after meandering through Europe, they ended up in the Netherlands in 1696 or something like that. 1796, sorry, I lied. 1796, something like that. And from then on, we became a very extensive family in the Netherlands. Like I said, I went to regular school and never had any anti-Semitic problems or anything. We had, in the Netherlands, by the way, was a very, very mixed country. Not just mixed up sometimes, but mixed. They were very mixed because the Netherlands had colonies. The Dutch East Indies, which was Indonesia today, and in the West Indies, in the Caribbean, Aruba, Curaçao, Bonaire, Suriname, and all that was all Dutch. All those people came to the Netherlands when they had jobs to do or as guests or married to Dutch officers who went out there to administer. So in our schools, we had colors, really all the colors of the rainbow, from the very black from some of the places in the Caribbean to the coffee-colored from Indonesia. And I, as a kid, never heard any, at least not in my presence, I never heard any disparaging word, as the song says, about those people or myself. There was some teasing. Hell yes, there was teasing. We teased and they teased and everybody teased, like just like they do today. But there was very little bullying and all that. So, had a great time. I loved it. I was more Dutch than the Dutch. I always giggled at my parents when they couldn't hold a tune. They couldn't hold a tune, and so they couldn't sing the national anthem properly. And I always had a giggle. Like I said, all that changed when the Germans came, when the Nazis overran the Netherlands, which happened from 10 to 15 of May 1940. They started on the 10th with a lot of attacks. They ended on the 15th when the Dutch capitulated. They had no army to speak of. And there was so much treason. And behind the lines, maneuvering by Dutch sympathizers, because the Dutch sort of sympathized always with the Germans. They did not really hate the Germans, never, until the war, until they started doing nasty things. But they'd never hated them, because the cultures are very similar. The languages have some similarity. For a Dutchman to learn German is easy, and vice versa. And to understand German is fairly easy. You have to be careful, of course, because some words really sound like, but they don't mean the same thing. But in general, the culture was also similar. The precision, the love of discipline, the Dutch had the same love of discipline as the Germans had. And so they admired how the Germans pulled themselves up by their bootstraps from the ravages of World War I. So when the Germans came, there wasn't that much resistance in the beginning. That started really only after the Dutch themselves started to feel the load of the onus of the occupation. And I don't have to repeat to you all that happened, because most of you have read books. You've read Anne Frank's books, probably, and other books which have appeared on over the years about what the Germans did and how they proceeded. The funny thing was, or the strange thing was, that the Dutch people, the Dutch Jewish people, never really believed, until it was too late, what was going to happen. You remember what happened with people like Eli Wiesel, when he went to the village there and saw the things that happened there, came back, told his people. They said, nah, that's not going to happen here. Well, the same thing the Dutch said. When Jewish people, Jewish refugees, came from Germany, and there were loads of them, they started coming approximately in 1935, the majority. And it was even more so after Kristallnacht. But 1935, there were already a lot of Jewish emigres who came from Germany. And I think the Franks were among them. They came in, I think, in 1936 or 1937. I don't remember. And there were many others, amongst them the family of Arthur Grunewald, who was the father of my girlfriend. I met him only once, and he was picked up pretty soon afterwards. and sent to Germany, back. But, yeah, I started early with girls, I'll say that. And so I was about six, seven. And I had my girlfriend and I was going to marry her. Darn it. Oh, we were serious. But anyway, so we heard stories. Our parents heard stories. They said it won't happen here in the Netherlands because we won't let it happen. Or the Dutch will not let it happen. Like hell they did. Of course they did let it happen. It happened. And in many cases, with their full cooperation. I can tell you now, here, right now, that had the Dutch had the same guts as the Belgians and the French had, in general, the same proportion, many more Jews from the Netherlands would have been saved. Out of the 140,000, close to 80% never returned. And that was due to the fact that there was not much help from the Dutch population. There was help, and some people really went out of their way, like in many places, to help those Jewish people, those victims. But in many cases, that didn't happen. Okay, now, what happened to us, to me? In the beginning, it was tough at school, because my good friends, I thought they had been good friends, non-Jewish good friends, one by one fell by the wayside. Whether it was, like they told me, because their parents didn't want them to play with me, or be with me, or be seen with me, or be seen with anybody who was wearing a star, or had been seen going into a synagogue, or anything like that, or whether they were also sort of a little bit anti-Semitic at heart. I don't know. I don't know where they are. I haven't found any of them, and I'm not looking for them. But obviously I lost my friends. And at school, it became very hard for us. Because we were now targets. Because all of a sudden there were all these little bullies. They sprouted up like toadstools in the spring when it's nice and wet under your trees and in your grass and you want to get rid of the dying things. And they were there all of a sudden. People I'd never thought who'd hate me. Why would they hate me? What had they done to them? I didn't know. And I wasn't... Hey, in 1940... When the Germans invaded, I was just 8 years old. I went when the invasion, and the rest of the year I was 9 years old. So I was 9 years old. So I didn't know. I didn't understand the darn thing. I was used to playing and having fun. That was over. They didn't let us have fun. They pestered us. Sometimes they beat us. We had fights. The Jewish kids grouped together. And in my school, for instance, we had a gang, a Jewish gang, you could call it. It wasn't an organized gang. There was no leader or whatever it was. But it was a gang. And there were other gangs, much bigger, older, and they were the Nazis, the kids of the Hitlerjugend, equivalent in the Netherlands, the Hitlerjugend, as it was called. And there would be clashes, serious, in school and outside school. So we were separated. All of a sudden there was a Jewish school, only Jewish kids, and a non-Jewish school. Well, that did not stop the fights, but at least the fights were not in the schools. Now they'd brought it outside, and it was easier to get at them. There were more people seeing it and so forth, and calling the police and They would separate us. Some of these fights were very bad. And if you were ganged on by a couple of bigger thugs, like I was once or twice with my friends, because we never went alone anymore from home to school, from one home to the other home. If you had to walk alone, there was a parent who went with you. And then when you came to your friend's home, then there were two, so that was better than you could go alone. So we got together. We had to do everything together. We had to defend each other and ourselves. It wasn't pleasant. Then there were all those posters. And I don't see anything threatening on the wall here. But the posters, which were on the streets, were threatening and frightening and horrible to us. Because there were all these monstrous people looking straight at you, like Uncle Sam is pointing at you. I want you. Only it didn't say, I want you, I hate you, it said. You're a piece of whatever you want to put in there as a last word. So it was hard. And many times I came home crying or with torn clothes or whatever, what have you. Everything was taken away from me too. We had a dog. I wasn't allowed to have that dog anymore. My friend, my dog. You know what it is for a kid to lose his dog? Was his best friend, besides his girlfriend. My bike, our radio, this, that, everything. You were nothing. And then there was a curfew. You couldn't go out whenever you wanted anymore. You couldn't roam because parks were closed to you. You couldn't go to a public swimming pool. You couldn't go to a theater, a movie. You couldn't go to an ice cream store. Where could you go? Nowhere. At home. And if you arranged it properly, you could have a friend stay over. But he had to stay over until the curfew was out. And that was the next morning. Well, it wasn't easy. It wasn't fun. It was certainly wasn't fun for me. But I know what hell it must have been for my parents. Having grown up and having had kids, I know what that means. A kid is sort of a magnifying glass. The troubles he has are magnified when they get to the parent, as far as the feelings are concerned. So anyway, of course my dad lost his job, like all the other Jewish people. He worked for a while in a bakery, and I can still see him mixing dough in a bakery, totally covered in flour. He was rather a swarthy individual, but he was white that time when I saw him. And I still remember the cookie he gave me. It was a German cookie called Baumkuchen. Anybody know that? Yep. I figured there would be somebody who knew that. Baumkuchen. And he lost his job because everything was closed to the Jews. And then they sent him to a work camp. He was picked up. You know, they had these euphemisms for camps. One was a work camp, and a work camp was supposed to be a camp where people were put to work, and they actually got a little money which they could send home to help the family. Well, it wasn't much money, and it was hard work, and so I don't know who enjoyed it, because they were just digging ditches and so forth and all kind of things. But then one day, he heard that from the German guards that they were going to round the whole bunch up and close the camp. And he understood what that meant and decided this was the time to get out of there. so far, it hadn't been too bad. They were not mistreated. They were fed. They had their rest periods, and they could send some money home, and they could write home, and they could actually sometimes telephone if there was a telephone available, if the line was working, I mean. And so he decided to escape. But by escaping, he wasn't only a Jew, which was a minor character in the society, but he was a criminal, because he had acted against the order of the Reichsführer, Seyss Inquart, who was the ruler of the Netherlands at the time, the king. And he became a criminal, and as a result, we were criminals. It was the first time that there was a real that I was a real criminal. And we all had to go into hiding after he escaped. Somehow, I don't know how he did it, but he got names, addresses. He had them apparently, and we met him on a farm. On a farm, not about, oh, I would say probably about 40 miles east of Amsterdam. For me, it was wonderful because I could be outside. I could work. I could learn how to do things. Things I had actually already learned over the years in the village where my grandparents lived, because that was a farming village in the eastern part. And, you know, in the Netherlands, the farm, in those small German farms, too, German villages, the farms are in the village. The farm buildings are in the village, and the fields are outside. And in the mornings, the farmers go out to the fields and do whatever they have to do there. And so the concentration of farms is huge, around usually around the church. And I learned a lot there as a kid. I liked working. I liked animals. I liked doing things. I've always been active. And I learned how to milk. I learned how to harness a horse and all these things I learned already. By the time I was 10 years old, I could do all those things very well. And so when I came to that farm, I could do that again. It was wonderful. I worked. And unfortunately, I never had a calendar. So I can't tell you how long we were at that farm. And we've been trying to trace that, and I've been trying after the war to get in touch with the farmer, whose name I didn't know. And the farm and that whole area had been obliterated, not during the war, but after the war, because of the new highways they built. There was nothing there I didn't know where I was. It was from one highway to another highway. I was on my way to Germany when I went to one highway, and when I went to the other highway, where I thought that it might be in that area, I went to Belgium. It was impossible to find anything back, and the names that I had forgotten, so who? I never got in touch with them again. Another unfortunate thing there on the farm was that I was sexually abused by the two elder daughters of the farmer. They were about 6 years older than I was, and I didn't have much to say about the fact, except to comply and obey, which I did. They told me, if you talk, we are going to the police. And we are going to tell them that we have a bunch of Jews here. Well, so I didn't talk. I didn't want to go to a concentration camp. I didn't want to get my parents into a concentration camp because I knew that would be the result. And I'd seen the roundups in Amsterdam. I'd seen the cruelty and the sadism of not only the Nazis, the Germans, but also the Dutch Nazis, the Dutch police, which was quite complicit in all the measures against the Jews in the Netherlands. Although today they deny that, of course. Why should you agree? How do you prove it? Because those people don't exist anymore. That's the problem. So I complied, and we were there for quite a while. I think we were there 3-4 months minimum. And then we had to move for whatever reason, because my dad didn't tell me. In those days, parents didn't talk to their kids about things. Kids were too stupid, unless they were 25, 30, and maybe then, even then they were too stupid to understand. Kids didn't understand. You didn't tell them things. So I didn't know what the heck was happening. My parents, by the way, and those of others I've talked to, never talked to us, our parents never talked to us about what would happen in Poland or Germany or wherever when you were sent to the East. Never. Nobody, none of those kids knew what the hell was going to happen to them if they went. I'm sure a lot of them would have tried to escape. At least many more. And whatever you read about those, some of the survivor stories, you find that. They didn't know what was going to happen. So they didn't really try. Well, anyway, we had to move. We moved. We went to a city, nearby city. The city's called Amersfoort. Anybody who's ever been in the Netherlands might know where that city is. It's also east of Amsterdam. Beautiful old town. But we were sort of on the outskirts, near the railroad station, in a huge block of apartments. I mean, that was a huge, miserable block of apartments. It had 5 floors, including the ground floor. So it depends upon how you mark your floors. But we had a ground floor, first floor, ground floor, second floor, third floor, fourth floor, and so on. We were on the third floor. We had a room and a half rented from the lady below us who knew that we were Jews. And she closed off the whole apartment. But we only had a room and a half there. So the whole apartment was closed, but we had to be quiet. We had neighbors on all sides. We had above, to the sides, and opposite. So during the daytime, we couldn't be in front of a window. At night, if we wanted to read something, everything had to be totally closed because there was a curve. There was blackout. It was war. And we were close to a railroad station, which makes it even worse. So there we were. I have to take into account. This was in 1942. And I was 11 years old. 10 years old at the time when we went there. I was 10 years old. And I was cooped up with my parents in one room. Now you say, that's not so bad. Maybe it wasn't so bad for me, but it was hell on my parents because they had to keep me occupied and busy and doing things and making sure that they didn't make any noise. And I was a noisy kid. I'm still noisy. Right? I got an affirmation from the back. They had to keep me occupied. Now, well, what can you do 24/7? You can read, and of course you can sleep. But if you have no activities, how can you sleep? So you can read, and you can play games. And maybe you can talk very quietly, whispering nearly. So what games do you play? Well, you play chess. You play checkers again and again. You play dominoes again and again. all sorts of games, Parcheesi or something similar. But you can't really sit there and win a game and say, "Yay, I won!" Hell no, you have to be quiet. Because some people can hear you. And then they'll start asking, "Now, who's there? That apartment is supposed to be closed." And what does that mean? If somebody asks a question in the wrong place in a store and the wrong ears hear it, then those wrong ears will go to the police and say, "I think there might be Jews in that place." And if they go to that place and they catch those Jews, then they get paid. They get a reward. And this was wartime. Now, it was had already been since 1940. It had already been 2 years. This was the second year, sorry. And so things started getting tight. A lot of factories had closed because they were taken to Germany. All the machinery, all the good machinery was taken to Germany. And the good people who worked those machines had been taken to Germany. So, what were they going to do? People needed money. There was, of course, rationing. Everything was on rations. And, we were in hiding. Where did we get the rations? Well, we had to buy them through resistance people on the black market. That's expensive. So everything was expensive. By the way, this means also that only well-to-do people could really go into hiding. Because who had money for 4 years, 3.5, 4 years, or whatever it lasted, depending upon the time you went into hiding? Some people went into hiding in 1944, like the Franks. Only in 1944, but it was 2 years after we went. And so they probably would have had enough money to sit it out had they not been betrayed by whoever it was who betrayed them. And they were sent on the last transport out of the concentration camp in the Netherlands to Auschwitz. Well, then one day the bell rang downstairs. I remember that so well. The bell rang downstairs and the lady there pressed a button. You have these buzzers there, and they opened the street door. And steps came running up the stairs. And voices shouting, "Police! Stay where you are! Polizei! Stehen bleiben!" And I froze. I was petrified. This was it. My mother started crying, wailing. I can't really define the sounds she made, but she knew that this was it. And I stood there. I couldn't move. It was like a bad, bad dream that something is coming at you and you can't get out of its way, and you're trying and you don't know how to do it. And then my dad said a few bad words. I'd never heard him say those things, and he would have given me a week-long pain in the rear end if I'd ever said those words at home. I'd said them on the streets lots of times, but not at home. And he said those words, and from him to hear that shocked me out of my paralysis, and I ran to the back doors of the room, and I grabbed those doors and I opened them and pushed them open and ran onto a porch there and jumped on the railing. And just before I really jumped down, I didn't even really realize what I was doing with it. I looked over my shoulder, and I see my dad grab those two doors, pull them shut, and close them. And he waved at me like this. And then he did like this. Get out of here. Well, I did. I jumped. That was the last time that I either saw or heard anything about my parents, of my parents, directly. The next time I heard something was when I got a notice from the International Red Cross. But that was 20 years later. And so I jumped on the ground floor. The first floor was one of those round awnings. And I hit it at the right angle. It broke my fall. I slid down, landed on my feet, and found myself in front of a German soldier who had been posted there. Well, I think he was, really, I think he was just as surprised as I was to see him. He was just as surprised to see this little body coming down. But anyway, he had been posted there to stop probably everything, and I didn't ask him, can I go, sir? So I was off like a shot. And they have these, every apartment, ground floor apartment, had a garden behind it with walls between them. And I was over those walls and running and over the wall and running and over the wall and running. It was raining. In November, that's not rare in the Netherlands. It's always raining anyway. Most of the time, very gentle rain, but it was raining. It was wet. It was muddy. So I know I didn't look great. But I ran until I couldn't go anymore. And I was hysterical. I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know what I was going to do. I had no idea. And I ended up being out of breath, probably hyperventilating, what they call it now. I just, out of breath, I'll say, and panicked. And I knew I had to hide. So I climbed on a rain spout. I climbed up to the second floor porch, sat down underneath a tub, one of those galvanized tubs, which they had, every family had one, because those apartments were from the early 1900s, 1910 maybe, 1915, but they had no showers, they had no bathtubs. They had kitchens with a sink. They had a toilet with a sink. And that was it. If you wanted the bath or you wanted to do the washing, either way, didn't matter. That was what the tub was for. You heated water. There was, might have been a boiler if you were lucky, if you ordered one, if you bought one, and if they did install it for you. Or you could boil water in kettles, in big pans, on a gas stove. And then you took a shower, whatever, once a week if you were clean, once in 2 weeks if you were not so clean, etc., etc., etc. So I sat down under that tub and started thinking, what am I going to do? Where am I going to go? Well, at that moment, my body decided something else. Of all the tension and the fear, soldiers have had that problem. But I was a little kid. I was totally inexperienced in that kind of fear. I had to go. I had to go and do a big one. And I wasn't going to do it in my pants. Darn it. I was a clean kid, I was a clean Dutch boy, and you don't poop in your pants. And so I got out from under the tub, looked around, and in those days, all the houses, every room had in the corner, had a fireplace with a fire stove in it. Those were not open fireplaces. You put one of those stoves, good-looking stoves, in there, or you had a stove in which you could put a kettle and heat water, whatever. But anyway, they all had stoves, and they were heated with coal, wood, or anything else, coke, anything else that you could, and I'm not, don't mean to drink coke. The old coke, some people may remember that. And so those were the bags they brought in on bags, and they left the bags there, and you emptied them out. And there were paper bags as well, and I found a paper bag which is similar in, shall we say, consistency to the paper bags you use for putting leaves in. So it's not Charmin or anything like that. But it works. When I scooted out from under that tub, I found some of that paper, took it with me under the tub, did what I had to do, and put, and there was a flower pot out there. So I took the flower pot, put it all over the whole shebang there, and that was it. So now I could relax. But I couldn't relax because there wasn't enough space for me and my stubby little legs, and the tub wasn't that big, wasn't as big as I thought, when it was uncomfortable, so I got out from under there and went into the coal bin. Every porch had a coal bin in those apartments. So I got into the coal bin. Luckily, it wasn't full. Usually, they weren't full because nobody had enough money to fill that darn thing up all the way. And I sat there and started thinking, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? Where am I going to go? Now, I knew one thing. I knew one address. I mean, I knew the place where he lived, this man. And this man had helped us find our addresses and taken care of our ration cards. So I knew where he lived. It was close to a big tower, a big bell tower, one of those beautiful old-time towers from the Renaissance area, beautiful tower with these fantastic bells like the Wester Tower, which Anne Frank mentions in her book, which played every half hour. This one played even every quarter of an hour. So I decided I'm going to use that as a direction finder. Now take into account, it was night. It was dark. It was a blackout. It was a curfew. So I had to be awfully careful. And what I didn't tell you was that the raid happened apparently at 3 o'clock. I found that out later from the German police records. At 3 o'clock they came and raided us. Well, it was 9 o'clock by the time I got to those people's house, but I couldn't stay there. Couldn't stay there because the man of the house had to escape, because apparently the whole little circle of resistance fighters, which was 3 or 4 people, and all the Jewish people they had helped, they were all rounded up in the same raid. And at the same time, it was all very organized, like the Germans were. And so I couldn't stay there, because the Germans would come back, look for him, because he had escaped. Out of the 28, 27, 29, I don't know exactly, people who were on the list to be taken, 2 escaped, him and me. And I'm proud to say that even today on the old German records, I'm still a fugitive of justice. So I'm proud of that, since it's their justice. And I actually have somewhere a copy of the certificate. And so I couldn't stay there. It was clear. But they let me go and rest, and they gave me something to eat. They gave me some clothes. And when they all went to bed, I had promised them I'd get out of here, and I did. In the middle of the night, I took some more clothes, I'll say that. I stole. That was the first time that consciously I stole a number of things. Knife, cheese. They had a big dairy store, by the way. So there was cheese there. There were some eggs there. I made the mistake of putting an egg in my pocket. Didn't work. But you can always lick your finger. And it's food, you know. All of a sudden, you know the value of food. When you're on your own and you start bumming around, wandering around in the country, staying hidden over day during the daytime, raiding farms early in the morning when the wife and the kids were all busy doing other things. You can get in anywhere. I was very lucky. I was only caught once, and that was when I fell asleep in the wrong barn. And I was caught by a farmer. He wasn't gentle, but I gave him a name, and he promised, and I told him I would work for him. I can work, I can do this, I can do that, I can, you know, hey, you can go somewhere else and work for somebody else. And he did, while looking in the meantime for a name I had given him. And apparently this person was well known. And so he was found. He was given a message that I'm here. The resistance heard of it. They came, picked me up, took me to their place. And that's where I stayed the rest of the war. Having a lot of other adventures as well, because somehow during the war, there were lots of adventures to be had, even if you didn't want them, which was most of the time. So I'll stop here and have 10 minutes minimum more. I don't know. That depends upon Beth. I'll stop here and let you ask questions. Don't be bashful. I'm not bashful talking about anything. And so don't you be bashful asking about anything.
Lou, before we do open it up to questions, and we have some time, can you explain what it was like to be hiding out in the open? Can you talk about how that resistance movement allowed you to be under false identity?
Yeah, I was lucky. I was in the house of a group, of a center of a resistance group, which did administrative resistance. Not violent resistance, not raiding offices and so forth and all that, which always resulted in countermeasures, punishment by the authorities, and people suffered from that. So it wasn't a very popular option of helping people. Everybody had an identity card. My identity card is somewhere in a little canal in Hammersfeld. I know exactly where it went into the water. I don't know. It's probably somewhere miles underneath the water. But everybody had to have an identity card from age 15. Now, officially, I wasn't age 15. Or rather, sorry, officially I was, because I got a different name. I got a different identity, and that identity was foolproof. How did they do that? Because the Germans perfected their identity cards in the Netherlands to such a degree that you really could not falsify them. Every card was made out of three layers. They were bonded together in a manner that you could not separate them without breaking the seals, which you could see through either holding them to the light or things like that. You could not falsify those cards. Impossible. You could not insert a photograph like you could with so many others. You could not put a false fingerprint in there. That didn't work. because it was all sealed. And so, well, how do you still get people a legitimate card? Well, the system was in the Netherlands that everybody, when he was born or she was born, when a person was born, he or she got a card in the social register. And in that social register, and on that card, there were the date of birth, of course, who the parents were, who the grandparents were, what their religion was, and when they grew older, which school did they go to, what education did they get, did they leave school, did they get in trouble with the police, did they move to another town, and if they did move to another town, that card was kept there and a copy was sent to the new town, where they made out a new card to follow up. So the system was sort of foolproof. Once you existed in the Netherlands, that was it. So how do you get people a bona fide identity card? Well, the way to do it was to start looking in those registers where people were registered who had died. And you take those registers, you take those names, and you pull the card, and that had to be done in several places. You pull the deceased cards out and put new cards in those positions. This way, you don't change the count, anything, of the number of cards, because all those cards were all numbered. I mean, they were nuts, those Dutch, with their precision. So they put in new cards for every person whom they wanted to get a new identity for. And on the basis of those new cards, the government gave out identity cards. So if a legitimate person like that lost his or her identity card, he couldn't find it, you could get a new identity card. And they took, usually, when they made these false cards out, they made them out for a person who was approximately the same age. So I didn't have to have that in my case, because I had the name, address, identity and everything, and an identity card of a boy living in Amsterdam who was a relative of the guy who did all the, who thought it all up. And so I had an identity card, which was, if they called up that address, oh yeah, he's our grandson. And where does he live? Well, he lives right now with his mother's second cousin or whatever it was in Hammersfield, which was where I was living at the time. And where did he go to school? Well, there and there. And where is he going to school now? Well, there and there. So it was all set. This is the way they worked. It was a very difficult, very complex, but it was worthwhile because you saved people. Not one person who had been issued identity cards on that basis was ever taken. Well, they were taken into prison. There was one guy, a friend, actually, who was 5 years older than I was, but he was taken by the Gestapo, picked up, but they could not prove that his identity was not what he said was it was. They could never prove. He actually was sent to a camp where there were lots of Jewish people from Amsterdam, where he was born and where he saw some of his school friends. But he just went on and insisted, this is not me. These people are mistaken. Look at my identity card. And he got out of it. I've put his story in this little book which I wrote about it. And that's how they did it. I mean, it's much more, I told you now in about 6-7 minutes, it's a book full of things they did in order to accomplish that.
Before you left your home and had fun in school, you'd mentioned there were people of different nationalities and colors. How did those that were darker or coffee-colored, as you say, how did they react to the Nazis, or did they have to take sides as well?
They scattered just as we did, because they would be rounded up as well. They were rounded up as well, you know. But there were not that many, and certainly not, except in Amsterdam, where I lived, there were a lot of them. And in The Hague, probably, there were some also who were connected to the diplomatic corps or something like that. But the rest of the country, they barely you saw one at all. So I can only say of the ones which were living and in my school, they all scattered. I don't know, they tried to escape. Maybe they escaped early. We never knew because kids started from pretty early on, started disappearing day by day. All of a sudden there wasn't somebody there. And when we had roll call, they just shrugged their shoulders. Maybe you'll see them again, maybe not. But from my class, when I went into hiding, and the parallel class, there were two classes the same grade. From those two classes, out of about 50, 60 kids, I don't remember how many there were, those two classes combined, two returned. Two were alive that I know of. One is sitting here, and the other one is the stepdaughter of Otto Frank. He remarried, namely, and she was in the school there too. The Franks lived very close.
You've been listening to a program from the Institute for Holocaust Education on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Holocaust survivor Lou Leviticus, professor emeritus at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, and volunteer curator at the Lester F. Larson Tractor Test and Power Museum in Lincoln. Professor Leviticus' talk was given as part of the Through the Eyes of a Survivor speaker series, presented by the Institute for Holocaust Education at Omaha's Jewish Community Center. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, July 28, 2010, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Beth Selden-Doton, Executive Director of the Institute for Holocaust Education, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as podcasts of selected Noon Forum programs, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.